Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pope Benedict comes to America next week, to a country where one-fourth of the population is Catholic, and to an American church still in the throes of a moral and financial crisis. Pope Benedict says he's coming to extend a message of hope, peace, justice, and freedom to all. How will he be received? This hour On Point, the Holy See in America. Joining me now from New York City is David Van Bima, chief religion writer for Time magazine. He co-wrote this week's cover story, Why the Pope Loves America. David, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Nice to have you. Why is Pope Benedict coming to the United States? Why here? Why now?
Well, he was the given reason for coming to the U.S. is to speak to the U.N., but in effect, also, if you're Pope, you more or less have to make it to the United States at one point or another, so this is his shot.
I see. How would you describe him so far? We've known him as Pope for 3 years now. To your mind, how has he led the church to this point?
Well, I think that he surprised a lot of people, to be honest. He had such a record as sort of a ferocious protector of the doctrine of the faith when he was running that office in the Vatican. And by comparison, he's been relatively mild since then. I think most Americans know that there was a speech that he gave that got a bad response from Muslim extremists in Regensburg in Germany. But beyond that, I think that they're probably reasonably happy that he has turned out not to be ferocious.
And with that said, he's had a tough act to follow in many ways. How is he different from Pope John Paul II?
Well, John Paul II was sort of the outside guy, and Benedict is sort of the inside guy. John Paul II had acting experience, and he had tremendous charisma, and he went and his most powerful weapon was his personal presence. And Benedict is trained as a scholar, and I think that he hopes that he will make his biggest impression through his ideas as expressed not just in encyclicals, but expressed through his speeches and so on. He's not the same kind of pope, and nor does he have any illusions about that.
And having said that, then describe his relationship to this point with America and with Catholics in America.
Well, the latest polls show that he has a 75% approval rating amongst Catholics in America. So I would say that 3 years of his papacy and the fact that he has not spent it trying to uncover new heresies and rather has been writing about things like love and charity in his encyclicals have basically convinced American Catholics that they can at least live with him. They're not changing the behaviors that probably secretly or not so secretly annoy him the most. It's not as though they're starting to observe the church's teachings on abortion or on birth control any more than they have. But you don't see, you know, his negatives are low, his positives are high.
Negatives low, positives high. So what is his message then as he comes to the United States? What's his agenda while he's here?
Well, that's up for grabs a little bit. My personal take on that is that the message that will sort of work itself out over the mosaic of events that he's got planned is how to have an interreligious conversation. And what we wrote about in our story was essentially that he's fascinated by America because he likes to get under the hood and see how a country where you have a separation of church and state develop so many vital religious communities, including the Catholic Church. And I think that one of the reasons for his fascination in that is that he understands that we're entering a period where the world is full of very vocal religious pluralities who need to learn how to talk to one another. That includes, you know, primarily Christianity and Islam, but also everybody else. So it's not an academic question. And I think that if you look at the itinerary, you'll you'll see that it kind of comes up either sideways or front ways a bunch of times.
You mentioned this religious plurality. How is the American Catholic Church changing here? Who's going to church? Who's dropping out? What has your study shown?
Well, the American Catholic Church is like almost every other church in America in that it has, we didn't realize this until about a month or two ago when the Pew people did a study, it has just tremendous turnover. Of all the people who were born Catholic or who are cradle Catholics, of those people, 30% of them or 25% of them are no longer Catholic, so that one out of every 10 people that you see on the street on the average is an ex-Catholic. That's bigger than every other denomination except for the Southern Baptists, and it would be like the ex-Catholic denomination. At the same time, they've managed to keep their 60 million headcount by doing some conversions and also by a really huge influx of Hispanic or Latino Catholics who will change the face of the faith in the United States.
There are a lot of people who are wondering if Pope Benedict will address the sex abuse scandal in this country. He's the first pope to visit here since the clergy sex abuse crisis was uncovered. What do you think? How will he address that issue?
Well, as to whether he will do it, I think we now know that he will. He's scheduled to address it when it comes to St. Patrick's in New York, St. Patrick's Cathedral. How he will do it, we have hints that he will be apologetic or regretful and that he may very well talk to some sort of handpicked victims of sex abuse.
An apology?
Something very like that. But what he probably, or rather what the victims groups think that he will not do is assign any responsibility for the sex abuse crisis to the hierarchy, to the bishops who shuffled sex abusers around and so on. And they feel that that is really, at this point, the key point, because that was what distinguished this scandal from other scandals or from things that happen in Protestant churches. You actually do have a line of command here, and the people, there will always be predators amongst pastors, but they feel that it was the people who enabled it who stood out for being at fault, and those people have never really had much more than a hand slap, and they don't think that the Pope is going to get into it.
David Van Bima, chief religion writer for Time Magazine. Hold on just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation now from South Bend, Indiana, is Scott Appleby, professor of history at the University of Notre Dame. He's also the director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. He's been on our program many times to help us sort out the clergy's sex abuse crisis. Scott, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
What are your expectations for Pope Benedict's visit?
My expectation is that this will be an opportunity for the Pope to present more of his personality and his own range of views. Yes, 75% or so approve of him, but another third of American Catholics say they don't quite know him. If they don't know him after this visit, they won't ever know him because he'll have a chance to address the full range of concerns and his particular approach to it. David mentioned when you asked him the purpose of this visit, it's really twofold. It is to address the United Nations, and in that capacity, we'll see Benedict in his role as universal teacher and pastor of the church, who has also a moral obligation to speak out to the world about questions of morality, public policy, social justice, and the like. The other purpose of this trip, though, is to celebrate the bicentennial of five major dioceses that were founded 200 years ago, including New York. And in that regard, what we'll see is the other part of Benedict's identity and mission to the United States, namely his pastoral and priestly concern for the church in the United States. And I very much appreciated David's article in Time because it was in the mass coverage of this visit one of the more original and insightful treatments in that it drew attention to this Pope's attitude toward America, which is still, even after the crisis, a very vital center of Roman Catholicism in the world, and furthermore, a remarkable experiment in freedom and liberty that the Pope is intrigued by, as David pointed out.
He's intrigued by it, but has that vital center of Catholicism changed? Has it evolved over the last few years? And is there any concern about that, that it's moving in the wrong direction?
Sure. The concern, or the fascination, if we use that term, with freedom is twofold. On the one hand, the United States, the Church of the United States, up until 1965, for over 200 years of its existence here, had advocated to the Roman Catholic Church the benevolent situation of having a church in a setting where church and state were separated, where there was freedom of religion, and therefore a voluntary approach to religion, and therefore pluralism, many kinds of religion. The Vatican was very wary of that and condemned that as a principled approach to church-state relations until the striking event of the Declaration of Religious Freedom in the Second Vatican Council, which was engineered in part through the agency of an American Jesuit priest, John Courtney Murray. And the argument was won, in a way, by the American church, which said, look, in the world we're moving into, where there will be many faiths, there will be religious pluralism, we need to compete, and it's best if we have freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. Mm. There's also a downside to those freedoms we can talk about in a moment.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Pope Benedict's upcoming visit to America. He's on a 5-day tour making stops in Washington at a synagogue in New York City, and he'll celebrate Mass at Yankee Stadium. What do you want to hear from Pope Benedict? Can he be a voice, even a player, in interfaith harmony? I'm joined by David Van Bima, chief religion writer for Time Magazine. He co-wrote this week's cover story on the Pope. Also with us is Scott Appleby. He's a professor of history at the University of Notre Dame and director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. Scott, let me give you a chance to follow up where you left off before the break, the Pope being a player in interfaith harmony.
Right. We were talking about freedoms and the positive side of having the church in an open marketplace of ideas and being able to speak its message without coercion by the state. The downside of freedom in a pluralistic setting for the Pope is the thing he's warned most against. The term is relativism, that in this situation where there are many faiths, not only religious faiths, but secular faiths, including materialism, that's what counts, money, etc., there is a tendency that we've observed for many, many years in the church to mix and match, to say, well, there's truth out there somewhere, but we can't quite identify it. Let's take some provisional truths and say they're relatively true in my situation, my historical moment, and maybe the Baptists have a good idea and the Hindus and Oprah, et cetera, and we'll put them all together and make our own personal, construct our own personal faith. Well, the Pope has spoken out very strongly against that tendency, which he doesn't see as freedom but kind of a license, both in terms of ideas one has, but also ethically, that in ethical behavior, the church's doctrine is connected strongly to its ethical teachings, and if you de-link those things, you get license. I do whatever I decide is right, and we then have the decay of order, law, and society. So there are two sides of the freedom question.
David Van Bima, respond to that, this relativism that Scott speaks of, this notion, this tendency to sort of mix and match parts of the faith. Is Pope Benedict's stand on that different than Pope John Paul? From your research, how does it play?
No, they would be totally in agreement on that. I think maybe the difference between them is that John Paul II, although he was a very affable sort of had a very affable affect, really saw the United States in terms of that kind of relativism, and Benedict is equally interested in this pluralism notion that we've been speaking about. There's one way to divide it is to say that Benedict is very interested in pluralism outside of his church, or how his church can interact with other faiths by at least being able to speak a language that that they understand. But within his church, he remains as doctrinaire as he was. He's just not talking about it in quite as grim terms.
Scott Appleby, the Pope is going, as we mentioned, to Washington, D.C., to New York City. If you were in charge of his itinerary, would you add any stops to his trip?
Boston. I think the Pope should go to Boston and have a Mass in Fenway Park or someplace like Fenway Park and, yes, apologize. We're past the point of legal precise moves. The church has, its coffers are just about dry. There can be a way to protect oneself legally from the legal predators out there. And believe me, there are some. There are many, many victims. There are others, including some in the legal profession, sadly, it's hard to imagine, that are exploiting the situation. And so, yes, the church has to be very careful. The Pope has to be very careful about what he says and how he apologizes. Nonetheless, the church, especially in Boston, is hurting terribly. And there has been a sense since the latter days of John Paul II's pontificate when he was ailing and there was a slow response, at least so perceived, to the scandal, that this Pope needs to come out in a kind of dramatic, both ritually and directly, and say, look, we caused suffering. It was inadvertent. We disavow the people who did so and mistakes that were made at a higher level, and we're here to seek reconciliation. What can we do to help the healing? I would add Boston. Now, he can say those things in New York, and I hope he will, but the epicenter of the crisis and the church hurting the most across the country, and there are many local churches that are hurting, is Boston.
Well, you outline what...
May I?
Yeah, please, David, go ahead.
I would just suggest that Boston was, as far as I know, under conversation. There was they were considering that he would go to Boston, but I think, no, as they say in sports, no way he goes to Boston. And, you know, the reason no way he goes to Boston is because if he were to go to Boston, then the sexual abuse story would just totally swamp anything else that he was saying. All the other things that we've been talking about, despite, you know, what we've been chatting about, the hottest thing, and we've spent already a fair amount of time on it thus far, is the sexual abuse story. If he were actually to do the very brave thing and go to Boston, that's all that that we would remember this trip for. Now, I'm not suggesting that it wouldn't be the right thing to do. I'm just suggesting that the decision not to do so was not necessarily a dumb one.
Scott, you outlined what you'd like to... Well, let me just ask you this. You outlined what you'd like the Vatican to do and what you think is the right thing to do. What has the Vatican's response been to the scandals in the last couple of years, since some time has passed?
I think the response has gotten better, but kind of belatedly. During the crisis, 2002... the church was a deer caught in the headlights, and that's to speak charitably and with respect for those folks. Not that they would ever want to be compared to the Clinton administration, but when the Clinton administration hit a crisis, you remember the spin cycle was out, and in 48 hours they had their version of the story. It took months for the church in this country to mount an effective response, which it did under the leadership of Bishop Wilton Gregory and Archbishop Harry Flynn, a very solid and reasoned and compassionate response in the charters that were devised for the protection of children and young adults. It took too long, and there was a large gap. And I just can't resist responding to David's point, which I agree with, but if he's only remembered in this visit for addressing the sexual abuse scandal directly and effectively, it'll be worth it because the church in the United States is reeling from this scandal, and we don't want it to overshadow all the other good things the Pope will say. But if on the other hand, there's not a follow-up in a strong, direct way in this visit, given the lag time earlier, that there'll be demoralization on that score.
David, do you want to respond?
Do you think that – I'm sorry, but it's my instinct to interview. But Scott,
go ahead, it's okay.
Do you think that he'll talk about the hierarchy and the abuse scandal? Because if he doesn't, he may win a public relations coup. That is to say, people around the country and a lot of Catholics will say, well, he apologized, so it's okay. But do you think that he'll actually talk about anybody but the predator priests? Will he talk about the people who enabled them?
I think you're right. I don't think he's going to say anything publicly about the hierarchy. What he says privately is another thing, and I don't think anyone should expect him to criticize the bishops directly. But there are ways rhetorically of making the point without pointing a finger directly. That there's the kind of language Pope John Paul II used that didn't satisfy everybody, but was clearly apologetic language of apology, of remorse. He made the useful distinctions between the church in heaven and in capital C church, the metaphysical reality, and the misbehavior of certain Catholics who were erring and went astray. This pope could do the same thing, and we would get the message, depending on how he articulates it, that yes, we were all, to some degree, at various degrees, responsible for not stopping this thing when we should have.
Gentlemen, let's go to the phones now and bring in Jerry, who's on the line from Ashaway, Rhode Island. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is, I understand that the Pope is somebody who's at least quoted as being very enthusiastic about religious plurality, but I'm somebody who grew up Catholic, came to find out that people in my generation and in my parents' generation were victims of clergy sexual abuse. I became an ex-Catholic, but I'm a very, very devout follower of Jesus Christ, and I'm a Protestant. And I remember last year the Pope saying that Catholics were the only true Christians, and he hoped for some sort of reconciliation, but, you know, that somehow we were all damned because we were not Catholics. I send my kids to Catholic school. Sometimes I go to Catholic Mass, and there's a very sternly worded thing in the front of the missal that says, I can't take the Eucharist because I'm not a Catholic. And I just feel less than, and I understand that there's this state enthusiasm for plurality, and like he's fascinated by us, but I don't like feeling less than, and I really resent that.
Jerry, thank you. Scott Appleby, would you respond?
Yes, I'm going to say two things. First, yes, when you hear that kind of language and you cringe, or we did, and many Catholics cringe, because it gives the impression, the wrong impression of church teaching if you're, in a sense, too legalistic in the language. The Pope is, after all, a professor. I know how that is. I'm one, too, and so he's very precise. But the other thing to say is, you know, you're not damned to hell. The church doesn't teach that. No, there's nothing. If you read the statements, it's not about individual Christians. Here's what it's about. This is back to my point about relativism. What this pope is particularly concerned with is the leveling of the playing field among religions. This goes back at least a century. James Cardinal Gibbons, Archbishop of Baltimore, was invited to the World Parliament of Religion in 1893, and he said that Our Father on a stage with Hindus and Buddhists and Baptists and so forth, and the Vatican effectively slapped his hand. Do not give the impression that the church, the doctrine here is about the churches, and the church is the fullest expression of God's self-revelation in Jesus Christ, and we don't treat it as if it's just one among many. So the criticism is not against other Christians, but against the statement is, how do we think of the word church? What's the full church? So Protestants, certainly there's dialogue with Protestants, there's recognition that they're Christians and followers of Jesus Christ. But the Catholic attitude, arrogantly or not, depending on your perspective, is we'd welcome you into full communion with that church, and you're only partially there. Now, that makes many of us uncomfortable, but that's the teaching of Vatican II is the fullness of Christ is in the Roman Catholic Church. Of course, the Holy Spirit and Christ is present in other Christians, and the Holy Spirit is at work in other faiths and around the world. So it's kind of, in one hand, an encompassing and an inviting kind of statement, while at the same time not backing off from, hey, folks, at the end of the day, we are the fullness of truth as much as we have it on earth.
Scott Appleby and David Van Bima, hold on. Let me bring another voice into our conversation now from New York City, where the Pope will arrive in just a few days. We welcome Father Richard John Newhouse. Father Newhouse is a Catholic priest. He's also the editor-in-chief of First Things, a monthly journal of religion, culture, and public life. Father Newhouse, welcome back to On Point. Always great to have you.
It's good to be with you.
What do you expect from Pope Benedict's visit? What do you hope for when he comes to the United States?
Well, I think it's worth mentioning that the Pope has already issued a statement, a preliminary statement, as to what he intends to do and how he understands this visit. And he has stated that the hope of the visit is to present to the American people and to the 60 or 70 million Catholics in America, especially, Christ our hope. That's his theme for this visit, Christ our hope. And that follows up on his second encyclical, Spes Salvi, We Are Saved by Hope. Some people will think, well, that's a kind of narrow, exclusively Christian message for him to be delivering. But in fact, his whole argument is that there's nothing at all exclusive about the message, Christ our hope. For Christ is, as he persistently says, and as he very notably argued at the Regensburg lecture that David Bima already mentioned, that the word of God, the logos, to use the Greek term, is both word and reason, and that this is something that is accessible to all human beings, so that the church, and here Benedict sees himself as the pastor. This is a pastoral visit. He's the pastor of the 1.2 billion Catholics in the world, and he sees himself as the one proposing to the world this capacity for shared reason. This is the nub of the confrontation is the wrong word, but the encounter with Islam, and he spelled that out at Regensburg, is that the use of anything other than reasonable persuasion in terms of the relationship between religions is a violation, he said, violence in particular, is a violation of reason and therefore of the very nature of God.
Let me ask you, what role do you think the American Catholic Church wants the Pope to play in their lives? Do Catholics want the Church to focus on a list of the non-negotiable issues like abortion and right to life, or do Catholics want a broader agenda that includes some sort of social justice coming straight out of, you know, Catholic social teaching?
No, what they want, and keep in mind that Benedict is very much of an Augustinian, that is to say, very much attuned to the spirit and the teachings of St. Augustine, the great 5th century bishop, theologian, philosopher, poet, and of whom the best word, known words, I'm sure, of St. Augustine are simply these: our hearts are restless. You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. What do the American Catholic people want? Sure, do they want some kind of clarity and closure, perhaps, even with regard to the sex abuse crisis? And do they have complaints about the administration of the church and the role of the bishops and the participation of lay people and et cetera, et cetera? Yes, all of that is true. But I would say it is a small minority of Catholics for whom those are the primary concerns. What most Catholics want to hear is Christ our hope. They are living lives in which they want desperately a word of spiritual inspiration, moral guidance, and encouragement.
So, Father, you think we're past the point of the Pope apologizing for the sex abuse scandal? You do not think he should apologize when he comes here?
Oh, no, I expect the wrong word. Look, the great sadness of these last 6 years since all of this broke in Boston in January 2002. Really, it had broken before that, but that's when it really gained national attention, the sex abuse crisis did. The great sadness is that throughout all of this, the word of grace and forgiveness, of sin and restoration, has not come through as the ringing message of the Church of Jesus Christ. And that gospel of sin and grace, of forgiveness, of the capacity of God to lift people up from their miseries and from their wrongdoings, is at the very heart of the reason for the Church's existence.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about Pope Benedict and the message that he'll be bringing as he makes his first papal visit to America next week. I'm joined this hour by David Van Bima, chief religion writer for Time magazine. I'm also joined by Scott Appleby, a professor of history at Notre Dame, and Father Richard John Newhouse. He's a Catholic priest and editor-in-chief of First Things, a monthly journal of religion, culture, and public life. I want to go right to the phones. First up here is Marianne, who's calling from Boston. Welcome to you, Marianne.
Hello, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the response of gay, lesbian, transgendered Catholics to the upcoming papal visit. You know, this is clearly a community that has been alienated from the church to a large degree, from the official church, by, you know, more than 20 years of attacks that have come against our community from this pope. And we're certainly aware of that during this visit. But at the same time, you know, as we think about it, we also see tremendous growth in support for us and for our civil rights among the people of the Catholic Church. So there's a tremendous dichotomy out there that, you know, the Pope's visit really points to among the people of the Church and the hierarchy of the Church. And that's just played out certainly on our issues, but in many, many other ways as well.
Marianne, thank you. Scott Appleby, would you respond to that, Marianne's comments about this disconnect between the people?
Yes, this
and
is a very difficult issue for the Roman Catholic Church, because the consistent teaching of the Church has been that homosexual acts are objectively disordered and therefore sinful. Orientation, homosexual orientation, is not in itself sinful. And it's true, this pope, in his previous role as prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, has been very, again, precise on this matter. There is a relationship, though, between the teaching of the Church always and the pastoral application of the teaching, and this has also been a contested area in recent church history, with some people saying the application, how we actually engage with people, should be much more flexible and compassionate than the necessary precise statement of doctrine. Still, it's a very, very controversial area. For example, in the priesthood, by many reports, a significant minority of priests have a homosexual orientation, and yet many of these priests, as most parishioners will attest around the country, have been faithful and good and compassionate priests and celibate. And yet there's some controversy around whether or not those people with that orientation can be admitted into the seminary and be ordained. So I recognize the one other point. There is a gap, as the caller mentioned, between the American Catholic, the Catholic reception to gays and lesbians, which is much more accepting in general, although not at odds with a kind of official pastoral relationship. But the difference is American Catholics don't, by and large, have in mind that homosexuals are somehow objectively disordered. And that's where there would be anxiety on the part of the teaching church, especially the Pope, about what we called before relativism or what would be considered a kind of fuzzy moral reasoning. So it's difficult, complex, and causes pain on all sides, really.
Let me switch gears a little for a moment and ask you all about the politics associated with the Pope's visit. Despite the extensive Vatican safeguards against partisanship, I imagine that during this political season, the activists on both sides are already trying to anticipate what the Pope will say, how to say it, how it will benefit them or hurt them. Will his visit be co-opted by the political process and the primaries upcoming in the United States? David?
Well, I think he's going to try very hard to avoid that. Cardinal Francis Stafford said the other day that the Pope didn't want to bring politically direct views here, but that his reflections should help Americans make a, quote, deeper moral judgment during the year's elections. I think that the Vatican is probably quite dismayed that the Democratic candidate has not yet been established. They really didn't expect the process to go on this long. They really didn't expect this visit to fall in the midst of a still hot primary season. Mm. And I think to some extent that issue is not going to be the issue it was in the last presidential election, because you don't have a Catholic candidate. Therefore, you cannot vet his views. On the other hand, I mean, in a place like Pennsylvania, with the Pennsylvania primary coming up, The question is, will the Pope's visit sort of energize Catholics to come out or to think of themselves more as Catholic? And who will that benefit? And thus far, at least in Pennsylvania, my understanding is that amongst Catholic voters, that Hillary Clinton is favored. So you could possibly go out on a limb and say that his visit would help out Hillary. But, I mean, you heard all the conditionals in my statement. Mm.
And let's go back to the phones for a moment. Again, Anne is in Manchester, New Hampshire. Anne, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I tuned in late, so I'm not sure. As a practicing Catholic, I'll get right to my point. I feel a certain dumbing down since Vatican II, whether it's the music, but particularly I'm hoping the Pope could address the quality of sermons, as we call them, homilies. Often there seem to be platitudes not evolved since my days of catechism, and to address us Catholics as a community with a responsibility to God and to each other, and to challenge us and not just leave them as passive.
Thank you so much. And Father Newhouse, I'll let you address that. Caller hoping that the Pope addresses the quality of the sermons that she hears every Sunday.
Well, the quality of the sermon, she also mentioned the music, and I expect she might have had in mind also the liturgy, and all of these have been great concerns of Pope Benedict. I think we will see in the way in which the Masses are done while he's here that he's deeply committed and embodies that commitment to a much more profoundly reverent understanding of worship and a much more intense understanding of the importance of teaching and the homily in the sermon, if you will, as the responsibility of the priest to be teaching the faithful. It is true that I think much of Catholic preaching is an insult to the intelligence of millions of Catholic parishioners. And a good example of what needs to be done about it is to listen very carefully to Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, because he will exemplify, as he does regularly, what it means to really use the homily to encourage, to instruct, where necessary, to reproach, to guide and inspire people to an encounter with Christ. As Benedict has said, he says, Christianity is not a system of dogmas, first of all, nor is it a system of moral rules. It is a love story. It is an encounter with Jesus Christ. And again, that is the theme of his visit, as he himself has stated it. Christ, our hope, and to present that with in an intellectually persuasive way that moves both mind and heart is, I think, a kind of model that he will set for what ought to be done in Catholic preaching and much else in the life of the Church.
Father, thank you. Back to the phones with Chris now, who is in Boston. Chris, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a Catholic, having lived in Boston for 40 years. I continue to be baffled and confused about the hierarchy's inability to accept responsibility. Specifically, Cardinal Law, having departed to a very cushy job in the Vatican, never seems to come up in these conversations. I would wish that the Pope, on his visit, would address the scandal in Boston and not speak of concepts like hope and redemption and faith, but rather something more pragmatic day-to-day.
Chris, thank you. Father Newhouse, still a lot of open wounds. You hear the caller, you hear it in his voice. What would you say?
Well, there's no doubt about it. And as Scott Appleby said earlier, Boston is the area that has been hardest hit. A remarkable thing about this, and you can either take comfort from it or you can interpret it in a less attractive way, a remarkable thing is that through this whole sex abuse crisis, is that there has not been a great falling away of Catholic participation in Mass, Catholic participation in the sacramental life generally, or in support for the Church. And is this a good thing or a bad thing? In part, it represents the devotion and adherence of the Catholic faithful. In another way, however, it has created a climate in which, not only in Boston but elsewhere, bishops are inclined to say, oh, isn't that wonderful? We finally got through that, thank God. And have not looked at their own responsibility or looked at, and this is a delicate question, and again, Scott Appleby touched on it very well, is the prevalence of homosexuality in the priesthood. I mean, over 80% of all the known instances of sex abuse were with boys, with young boys or teenage boys. And this is a problem about which there has been, to put it gently, a lack of candor, certainly a lack of public candor, on the part of the bishops. It's a, as to the bishop's own responsibility, we have a problem in that there is an enormous sense of fraternity among bishops, that you don't criticize one another. The papal nuncio, the pope's representative in the country, Archbishop Sambi now, is, of course, a link that could bring a disciplinary force to bear upon the episcopacy or the hierarchy in the United States. Whether that's going to happen, I don't know. It should happen, and it hasn't happened.
Let me turn the conversation to a different topic for a moment. David Van Bima, let me ask you what you think the Pope's role should be in a post-9/11 world. What should be made out of his trip, his visit upcoming to a Jewish synagogue? You know, what about his relationship with Muslims here and around the world? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that it's something that he's very concerned with, and I think that we've seen him trying to develop a dynamic to deal with other faiths. He sometimes seems to be tacking back and forth. For instance, the Regensburg speech where he quoted a Byzantine emperor who he later said he disagreed with to the effect that Muhammad was wicked or evil was in some ways a terrible faux pas. It's not how you get people to listen to you in a constructive way if you want to engage them in a dialogue. At the same time, subsequent to that, and to some extent coming out of that because some Muslim scholars sent him a letter, a real dialogue seems to have developed between the church and Muslim religious thinkers. By the same token, to the extent that he has brought back or allowed the Latin Mass to be said more frequently and maintained the language in it about the necessity of the conversion of the Jews, he has disappointed a lot of Jews who in general have seen a very positive arc in the Catholic Church with regard to Judaism since the Second Vatican Council. And so his visit with the rabbis, his visit to the synagogue on Passover seems like an attempt to tack back in the other direction. What he has to figure out, and he's very aware of it, is how do you stick to your theological guns and at the same time have a meaningful conversation with people who do not share your theological views. Mm. And he speaks explicitly about that kind of thing. And again, I come back to his interest in the United States, which is a place where, you know, Father Newhouse, as a veteran of the culture wars, will appreciate that when we're here in the middle of them, it seems like we're going at one another tooth and nail. But in point of fact, they're part of a basically healthy dynamic where people are actually able to say how they feel and to talk to one another. And in the end, it more or less works out. And I think that the Pope is looking for that kind of model for his papacy and his dealing with other faiths.
Scott Appleby, David says the Pope should stick to his theological guns. What role do you see the Pope playing in a post-9/11 world?
I think on the question of the war on terrorism, religious violence, and so forth, the world, and particularly those who link religion to violence inherently, have a lot to learn from the experience of the Catholic Church over the last 100 years. Until the Second Vatican Council, the Church's official teaching was that a rightly ordered state should be Roman Catholic. Since Vatican II, there's been a move toward religious freedom and a separation of church and state as acceptable and, in fact, endorsed by the Church. Furthermore, Pope John Paul II and, again, Benedict XVI have deepened the Church's teaching on nonviolence and the option toward nonviolence. So there's been a move away from the kind of structures of society that might implicate Roman Catholicism in coercion, in violence, and anything like terrorism. And so when the Pope challenges Islam on this point, it denounce any sort of violence, he's speaking in part from the experience of a church that has seen the depredations, the terrible consequences, in some cases, of identification with the state and political power as such. The other side of that, though, is that I think in the approach to Islam, this pontificate, we've seen a lot of growth because we have to recognize that Islam is not inherently violent. It's not inherently irrational. And some of the remarks in Regensburg were construed as blanket statements about Islam, which I don't think they were. And I think the Pope has done a lot recently to convey the fact that he wants dialogue with Islam and sees not only with Islam but also with Judaism points of real common ground and contact by which to oppose violence in the name of religion across the board.
In our last 30 seconds, Father Richard John Newhouse, I'd like to know what you think the direction should be or that the Pope should take in his religious leadership.
Well, again, this is a pastoral visit. Pastors encourage, teach, and where necessary, reproach. The most important thing to do is to listen to what he says. He is those of us who've known him for many, many years know that he is a man of not only deep scholarship, but of intense clarity of thought and an ability to communicate in a way that engages both the mind and the heart. And I would agree with both Scott and with David that the developments out of the September 2006 Regensburg thing with regard to Islam have created a new climate in which Islamic leadership increasingly recognizes that it must enter into and is invited to enter into an ongoing, open-ended dialogue with the Christian West, to use a somewhat outdated phrase,
yeah,
the extent that's still represented by the Bishop of Rome.
Father Richard John Newhouse, thank you for the last word from New York City. I appreciate your time. And Scott Appleby, joining us from South Bend, Indiana, professor of history at Notre Dame. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
And David Van Bima, religion writer, chief writer for Time Magazine. Thanks for your time and for your story, David.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.